This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. No, come on. This week, what kind of way is this to run an economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today. This one is the 1st of October. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. Round and round they go on Capitol Hill. Where they land, well, I am not taking that bet. But we're going to talk about it just a little bit, as well as other things economic that happened this week. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Heather Long is at The Washington Post. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Sudeep, let me start with you, and let's assume... Well, no, let's not assume they make a deal. Do you think, should we assume they're going to make a deal?
We should assume that they are at some point going to make a deal on some parts of this.
Oh, man.
Look, there are a lot of things.
That's the most waffling answer you've ever given in 10 years on this program.
I understand what people in parliamentary systems feel like right now, because we have different wings of the Democratic Party that are fighting with each other over what this looks like, and ultimately they're going to have to make compromises that everyone will hate and come together on something, because they don't want to just walk away entirely and say we're not doing any more legislation when we control the three pieces of the pie here, the House, the Senate, and the White House. And so they're going to end up doing something.
Do you think, though, Heather, that it will be true to what it seems the Biden administration started this entire effort with back in the campaign? That is, we're going to remake the position of government in this economy. If it gets scaled down, do you think that still holds?
It would be only a modest, more like a down payment if it gets scaled down. Mm-hmm. Yes, it would be at $3.5 trillion plus another trillion or so for the physical infrastructure. You know, you're looking at a pretty monumental amount of government spending increase. You know, that may not quite have the same impact of the New Deal under Roosevelt, but it sure would be the biggest remake we've seen of the economy, you know, in the last, and most people's lifetimes. But you're right, the more it gets scaled back, the more these programs go from being for everyone to only for certain groups of people, the less and less that this feels of the big sweeping nature that Biden had campaigned on.
Yeah. Sudeep, talking about the price tag here for a minute, we learned yesterday, thanks to, I think, you guys at Politico, that Senator Manchin told Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, in like July that $1.5 trillion was his top number. Number one, interesting that Schumer has known since July. But I thought the other part of that term sheet, I guess, that Manchin gave Schumer was interesting, specifically the line where Manchin said he wants the Fed to stop QE, quantitative easing, its bond buying program, as part of him approving this deal. What?
Yeah, look, Joe Manchin is not like the other Democrats in town. We've known that for a while. He came from a state where 2/3 of the voters voted for somebody other than Biden. And so we've been living in a land of unicorns and rainbows for the last 18 months. The Fed was just pouring money into the system. The Congress was pouring money into the economy. And obviously it didn't always get exactly where it needed to go. There was some misallocation of who was getting the money. But the economy was just flooded with either borrowed money or printed money. And anyone who thought this would go on forever just forgot the realities of Washington. And we're now facing the realities of Washington, where people aren't going to be comfortable flooding the system with money going forward, even if they think that, yeah, these are good causes, but in their view, the math doesn't add up. And so that's the comfort level that we have to get through.
I do want to point out, though, Heather, that and you tweeted about this morning. And look, we're going to talk about consumer sentiment here with Mitchell Hartman in a minute. But you did point out something that's really interesting in those numbers today. And that is that people are really worried that the wage gains they have made, and there have been some, are getting eaten up by this inflation that we have been promised was transitory.
Yeah, this is the biggest issue we're not talking enough about, and certainly policymakers aren't talking enough about it. People are feeling this inflation. We've got more data today saying inflation highest in 30 years. Mm-hmm. You can pick whatever gauge you want to use, but certainly home prices are up, auto prices are up, food prices are up, oil and gas prices are up. You sort of go down the line and people are feeling it, not just when they book a vacation. And it's eating into these wage gains. It's whatever metric, pick your favorite metric. You can see that in the last several months, inflation has totally wiped out wage gains, particularly for people who are kind of rank and file workers who are not managers. And people are frustrated about it. It's become a huge issue for the Biden administration. That's why the president's economic rankings are falling. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's why this consumer sentiment, at some point, does this become reality? People keep saying that they're getting more and more hesitant to spend money when they aren't sure if their pay is keeping up with inflation.
Sudeep, I thought it was interesting that Jay Powell on the Hill with Secretary Yellen this week a couple of times, he has stopped saying, oh, it's going to be transitory. And in fact, at one point this week said, yeah, who could have known?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people were, look, there were a lot of people screaming about hyperinflation in the spring, yeah. And you knew that they were wrong, but you probably knew that people who were saying everything's going to be fine, they were basically betting that this is going to be a spurt and then it comes down. There were real structural issues going on here in how we're spending our money, the shifts in how we're spending our money, the supply chain problems that are looking more and more horrific by the week. They're just like, they're ships that are at port, just like waiting weeks at a time to unload. All of that's going to go through the system, and we're about to face it in the Christmas shopping season where you're gonna have all sorts of howling about not being able to get what you want or pay what you want for it. And that's going to feed through and create more of a dynamic. And Jay Powell's just hoping and praying and betting that this will abate before it turns into an inflationary psychology that gets out of control. But we're clearly not there yet. We're still in that zone where we don't really know how it's going to turn out.
Yeah, it's all about that inflation expectations thing. Heather, complete change of gears with all the hubbub about infrastructure and keeping the government open. One is obliged to point out here, we now have 17 days until the debt limit, and Congress is wrapped up about all kinds of other things, except maybe defaulting on our debt. Discuss.
Right. This is the biggest problem from an economic and financial perspective. It's not an exaggeration to say this would be catastrophic if we have the United States unable to pay its bills and going into even a technical default for a few days. I keep trying to tell people this sets off a chain reaction of pain that you've been trying to hammer home to your listeners so well. Obviously, stock market would probably start tanking. Those bond yields would go up. That makes it more expensive for the government to borrow, but also for Americans. You want to get a home loan, you want to get an auto loan, you want to get a business loan. That's going to cost more. And if this keeps going for a while, folks in their Social Security payments that are supposed to go out at the end of October, there's Defense Department bills that are supposed to be paid. There's real consequences here, and ultimately it would certainly lead to a recession. So it's just kind of crazy that we're even in a situation where the United States government could truly default. And there's a reason that even a lot of Republican economists are coming out and really bashing Republicans for not joining together to get this done.
I was going to say something about the Republicans in Congress here, but I think that's already been said a bunch of times. Sudeep Reddy at Politico and Heather Long at the Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street today, volatility goes up as well as down. You know, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, we talked a little bit about consumers and how they're feeling, Heather and I did, but we're going to dig a little bit more. And before you say, Kai, more consumer stuff? Really? Let me just remind you, spending by or on behalf of us, the humble American consumer, accounts for fully 70% of this entire economy. So, we learned this morning personal income was up 0.2% July to August, while our spending was up 0.8%. Do the math on that one. Meanwhile, consumer sentiment, as measured by the good people at the University of Michigan, showed a smidge of improvement at the end of September. So what then does that tell us about us, the engines of growth and prosperity that we are? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
So those numbers out today, especially consumer spending up nearly 1% in August, looked pretty good to me first thing this morning. Then I looked at them again with Paul Ashworth at Capital Economics, and I guess there's a reason they call it the dismal science.
I'd argue it was a little downbeat.
First off, about half the increase in spending was actually an increase in prices from messed up supply chains and labor shortages and the like. After accounting for inflation, real consumer spending was only up half as much, and incomes actually fell in August. Ashworth says spending was also lower than we thought earlier in the spring and summer as the boost from stimulus checks faded.
The level of real spending really hasn't increased at all since April.
And consumers are feeling less upbeat. The Conference Board's confidence index has fallen for the last 3 months, says economist Lynn Franco.
Really, the Delta variant and the uncertainty that it's created has sort of cast a bit of a dark cloud over consumers.
Worries about inflation are adding to the darkness. On the bright side, there's jobs.
And there, what we're seeing is that people telling us that jobs are plentiful is at 55.9%. And that's actually an all-time high. And we've been doing this survey since the late 60s.
It is all a bit whiplashy. Income and spending weak, consumer confidence down, but workers who are also consumers upbeat and earning more. Take John Zaremba. He's nearly 50, lives in Napa, California, and works in AI software. He commutes, and he's looking to spend $40,000 on new wheels.
Thanks to the industry I'm in and all of us consumers buying a lot of e-commerce goods, my job and occupation is probably secure.
But getting a new car might be a challenge because dealers don't have many for sale right now. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Okay, the government's not going to shut down. For now, anyway. The spending bill passed yesterday keeps things going through December 3rd because Congress has never met a deadline it didn't like, I guess. But there is a practical side to this as well, beyond the politics. Down in the grinding gears of the federal government, how do you do your job when you don't know how much money you've got to do your job with? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains that one.
To the general public, the government will seem to be operating normally this fall. National parks will be open. The IRS will pick up the phone.
Social Security sends out the check. Medicare pays for your stuff. Offices are open. You can get your passport.
That's Laura Blessing at Georgetown University's Government Affairs Institute. She says the temporary funding bill includes extra money to repair hurricane damage and resettle refugees. So?
The damage that's done by funding the government is in this way is largely hidden from view.
Here's how it's supposed to work. Congress passes a series of spending bills and the president signs them before the government's new fiscal year starts on October 1st. But because lawmakers couldn't agree on those, instead passing a stopgap funding bill, agencies have to keep running on last year's budget. Max Steyer, head of the Good Government Group Partnership for Public Service, says everything's day to day.
So for me, the metaphor really is, you know, you're going to buy and eat a whole loaf of bread, but you're only given the money to buy each slice of bread individually, one at a time.
You can't buy in bulk, so you end up spending a lot more. And you can't change how you spend money. So if a Navy ship is being repaired and you need more welders than you had in last year's budget, too bad. Mackenzie Eaglin is a defense analyst at the American Enterprise Institute.
What you can't do is go out, post an ad, and say, we need welders and solderers hired here today, and then bring them on board quickly.
And Eaglin says the Pentagon can't even retire old ships or weapons systems it doesn't want anymore. All this adds up to unnecessary waste and inefficiency, which taxpayers will eventually pay for, even though they may not notice anything different over the next few months. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
really seeing an explosion of consumer choice.
Power to the car buyer. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 482 today, 1.4%, 34,326 on the blue chips. NASDAQ up 118 points, 0.8%, finished at 14,566. The S&P 500 gained 49, about 1.1%. 43.57. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow off 1.3%, the NASDAQ down 3.2%, S&P 500 down 2.2%. Merck shot up 8.3% today after the company said its experimental COVID-19 pill helped people in the early stages of that disease not get seriously sick and die. If you're traveling on the road this weekend, expect a little pain at the pumps. AAA says average price of a gallon of regular gas, $3.19 a gallon. A year ago, $2.19. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Kristen Schwab did a story this week about union labor in the service industry, bars and restaurants in particular. And in setting up that story, I pointed out that organized labor has seen better days, that just 11% of the American workforce is unionized. And that makes this an interesting and a somewhat challenging time to be the new president of the AFL-CIO. Liz Schuler has been on the job for about 2 months now. Ms. Schuler, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me on the show, Kai.
You had a piece in the Chicago Sun-Times a couple of weeks ago in which you said the current model of American capitalism basically creates instability, it threatens democracy, and you said, welcome then to a modern labor movement. And the question I have to ask you now is, what does a modern labor movement look like?
Well, a modern labor movement is a movement that grows and changes as the economy grows and changes. And we want to be that movement that meets the needs of workers in the future to make sure that, you know, the jobs in emerging industries are good, high quality jobs to support a family. We think one job should actually be enough. And we want to be that bold, dynamic, inclusive place to unite working people and, you know, show that when they come together, they're more powerful and we can actually make the economic scales work for them because we see inequality at record highs and workers actually need more power, you know, to leverage and demand that better paying job. And so we think that a dynamic and modern labor movement will be the place to do that.
The catch, of course, is that while support for organized labor is very high in this country, something like 11% of the American workforce is unionized. That's a low going back, you know, decades and decades. What do you do with that as the woman whose job it is to make that number go the other way?
Well, we have a lot of faith and hope in working people. And what we're seeing out there is a demand for change. And so our challenge is in the labor movement to connect the dots for people, to show that when you stand up through a union, that you're better off, you have better pay, you have that security, and you can retire with dignity. And that's what's missing in this economy. So we hope that more workers, since we have everything lined up right now, the popularity of unions is so high. We have a Gallup poll that showed that 68% of the public sees the labor movement, sees unions favorably, including 77% of young people, that now is the moment of opportunity for the labor movement.
With all respect, though, ma'am, you know, faith, hope, and popularity don't pay the bills. So I have to ask you about moves in Congress to help your cause. The House has passed, as you know, the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, the PRO Act. It now sits having passed one House, and the prospects in the Senate are up in the air, shall we say, as a lot of things are in the United States Senate. Where do you go from here at a national level?
Well, the PRO Act is one piece of a workers' first agenda that we've been pushing for. If you don't have the right to come together in your workplace and demand and bargain for better wages and conditions, then the rest of democracy crumbles around us. And I think we're seeing that people have less faith in democracy because of the economy and how it's treated working people, and people have lost hope. And so we are advocating for, yes, the passage of the PRO Act and, you know, getting pieces of the PRO Act in any legislative vehicle we can find, including reconciliation. But we also see the role of the labor movement to advocate for working people and the plight of working people in our country, including preserving democracy and getting the needed investments that we need in this Build Back Better agenda.
That's a big swing, linking the fate of this democracy to the economic advantages of unionized labor. And I point that out just to make sure that people understand what it was that you said without making a value judgment on it. But I wonder what it says about that linkage that Congress can't agree on what day it is, let alone what to do with organized labor.
Well, Congress is busy at work as we speak, trying to come to terms on what this investment agenda is going to look like. And right now, workers are getting the short end of the stick. The inequality levels are sky high. We have a polarized economy where some people are doing very well and others are, you know, most of us, the 99%, have to work two and three jobs just to get by when we think one job should be enough to support a family. So that's what we're advocating for, is that the labor movement will be that center of gravity for working people to demand more and get their fair share of the growth that's happening in the economy.
Liz Shuler, she is the president of the AFL-CIO. Ms. Shuler, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
Told you about the woes facing the automobile industry low these past number of months. Pandemic, plant shutdowns, chip shortages, general supply chain agita. Well, in spite of all that, electric car sales keep on going up. According to the consulting firm Atlas EV Hub, electric vehicles in the United States were nearly 5% of all light-duty vehicle sales this past July, nearly double a year ago. And yes, fine, okay, sure, Tesla does still dominate the market. But Ford's opening factories in Kentucky and Tennessee specifically for electric cars, and there are incentives and some EV infrastructure funding in that $1.5 trillion hard infrastructure bill that Congress is grinding away on. As Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, EVs are kind of having a moment.
Okay, let's not lose context here. Electric vehicle sales, excluding hybrids, still only make up a little more than 2% of sales, but the growth is strong. And there are a number of reasons for that: climate policy, industry investment. But Chris Harto at Consumer Reports says ultimately it boils down to automakers meeting the market.
Up until about a year ago, if you wanted an EV that cost less than $50,000,
all of your options were compact cars.
Which he says aren't really that popular even among cars with combustion engines. Then over time, Tesla had competition. Volkswagen and GM introduced less expensive SUVs, and Ford says it has 120,000 pre-orders for its EV F-150 truck, which is scheduled to launch next spring.
Really seeing an explosion of consumer choice, and it's just getting started.
Now, automakers investing in more EV variety is certainly important, but Paul Bledsoe says we shouldn't discount how much government policy plays into transportation evolution. He was a consultant to the Energy Department under President Obama. He now works for the Progressive Policy Institute think tank.
The tax incentives are crucial to get people into the EV driver's seat.
The current budget reconciliation bill in Congress would add even more tax incentives, so the total possible credit could be as high as $12,500. But for all that practicality, Stephanie Brindley at the consultancy IHS Markit says this shift in the auto industry boils down to what people want.
Cars do tend to still be an emotional purchase. There is a ton of choice out there. So we definitely do a lot of rationalization for what we really want.
And she says what some people want right now is to feel good about the environmental consequences of what they're driving. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a reminder that the politics of this economy actually matter to, you know, people. One of the things that's happened because Congress can't get to yes on infrastructure is that funding for what are known as surface transportation programs, highways and bridges, those kinds of things, money to pay the people who are the human infrastructure that keeps all that actual infrastructure safe and functioning, that money has stopped. It's just gone away. The Department of Transportation furloughed 3,700 people today. All right, we're going, but here's your moment of economic context. Another entry in the inflation logbook. Heather made reference to this today. The Fed's preferred measurement, something called PCE, the Personal Consumption Expenditure Price Index, which I think ought to be PCEPI, right? Anyway, it came out this morning, up 4.3% year over year, 3.6% for what's called core inflation, which excludes food and energy. But let me just say with a tip of the hat here to Mitchell Hartman, ain't nobody lives in the core. We all eat. We all lose energy, right? Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend. All right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.